This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we start with our history of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Did you know that a handful of loyalists had been sentenced to death by hanging? HPR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Yes, very fascinating bit of history that a local historian sort of rediscovered for myself, having been born and raised here. It was a little embarrassing that I hear about this before, but before I bring our historian into it, let me give our listeners a little bit of context. So the event we're talking about is the 1895, what was called at the time a civil war, or Kaua Kuloko. I think over time it's sort of been not reduced, but the narrative changed to a rebellion. And this was by loyalists for the Hawaiian monarchy that were looking, took up arms to try to restore Queen Liliuokalani to the throne 2 years after the initial overthrow. And so Ronald Williams Jr., historian here in Honolulu, came across this book of photographs. I'll let you tell us what he found.
Yeah, it was a really moving experience. I was doing a project for the Hawaiian Judiciary Center. They are working on rewriting their master narrative about Hawaiian history and judiciary in Hawaii. We're incorporating Hawaiian language sources and starting to add those sources to their history. But in doing so, I was able to go through their archives. And one of the things I discovered was this book of booking photos. And I didn't know what it was at first. And so you open it, and it's this old book of photographs. And once it hit me, I mean, they were literally titled Piokalai Aina on top, you know, which is political prisoner. And to understand that rebellion in 1895 and understand that something happened on the battlefield, but these folks that were arrested later on just simply because they were supporters of the Queen.
Right. So we've got some of these photos available on our website, but they're these sepia-toned booking photos of mostly men are the photos that I've come across with sort of, their prisoner number on their shirts, and then either a first name or a last name on the bottom of their photos. But an estimated 143 men were captured as prisoners of war during this sort of week-long battle here on Oahu. Started in Waikiki, went up through Palolo, Mo'ili'ili, and ended about 7 days, 6 to 7 days later in Manoa and Nu'uanu. But after this initial battle, what Williams is sort of alluding to is the Republic of Hawaii, the provisional government at the time, went ahead and started rounding up any really top Hawaiians that were sort of known to have supported the Queen. They wanted to really break the back of the resistance, as Williams puts it. So he shares the story of one in particular, a judge from Maui, and what happened to him once he became this political prisoner.
And so they arrested him. They charged him with treason. He had nothing to do with it, but nonetheless, they brought him to prison. He wrote two letters that I found from prison to his wife at home and asked her how she was taking care of the kids. He was terrified. He's got 10 kids. While he was in prison, they foreclosed on his mortgages. He ended up losing his businesses, and he went bankrupt. He got out of prison. He was blackballed, so he couldn't find a job. And then about 18 months after his imprisonment, he took his own life. And, you know, and so we think about these impacts of taking a whole generation of Kanako Iwi and identifying them as prisoners, folks who had been leaders. As I said, he was a district judge in Wailuku, and now he gets out of prison and can't even feed his family.
Yes, yeah, so Judge William Henry Daniels, sorry, I cut that one a little short. He was, at the time, he owned Maui Fruit and a tropical fruit and sugar company on Maui, and also owned about a third of Ko'olawe, 10 kids, very prominent judge over in Maui. But he was a prime example, William says, of some of the top Hawaiians that were arrested at the time. So total about 240 political prisoners that were actually arrested, jailed. And then, as you said earlier, seven of those were sentenced to death by hanging. The others were, you know, sentenced to hard labor and also with large fines as well. But for the seven that were sentenced to death by hanging. There was a deal struck, basically, between the Republic of Hawaii, who approached Queen Liliuokalani at the time, saying, we will commute these sentences to 30-year sentences instead of death by hanging if you go ahead and sign the abdication to the throne and hand over your power to this provisional government, to the Republic of Hawaii. And I think after much deliberation on behalf of the queen, she did end up signing the abdication papers under duress. But this sort of turning point, I think, is what Williams called it, in sort of the narrative, this idea of Native Hawaiians being prisoners and not just these families, but I think the change in the narrative for the entire Lahui, for all Native Hawaiians at the time, really made an impact. And he says at the time, it wasn't really, you could see the discussions in Hawaiian language newspapers or in some of the books that came out at the time, and the discussion, they didn't really believe, a lot of the people at the time didn't really believe the narrative that, all these Hawaiians were prisoners and were not worthy of having, these good jobs and being accomplished and successful. But he says if you sort of tell that narrative long enough and fully enough that, people start to be removed from the truth. So it's a really interesting sort of bit of history to uncover. But he also, a lot of his work, he's been also working with the Ahahui Hawaii Aloha Aina and as a historian and sort of uncovering these patriots, you would call them, people that were at the forefront of this movement to sort of restore the kingdom, but to also keep the history and the stories of the Hawaiian people alive. And he talks a little bit about what he thinks is really the power of history.
Right. And for me, it's a matter of just getting the history out. What happens because of that is outside of, I'm not a political scientist, right? I'm just a historian. But I do believe in the power of history. So one of the things I've taken on recently is a project of Po'eloha Aina cards. I took some of the glass plate photo negatives we have from the state archives, these beautiful photographs of these Po'eloha Aina who were pertinent and at the forefront of leading their nation. And I have these cards that I created, postcard size, and they're a photograph on the front, and then as much information as I could pack on the back. There's no more excuse that we don't have content, right? I mean, that teacher from Nebraska who's been here for 2 years and doesn't know anything about Hawaii, well, here you go. Here's primary resource content. And importantly, it's kanaka o'iwi for folks to look up to.
That's right. So he's sort of trying to bring back the tide and change the narrative by having these cards, these Po'eloha Aina cards, available as a resource to our teachers here in Hawaii for free, really by donations and whatnot. So it's an interesting way of, once you learn this history, figuring out what to do with it was sort of that next step. And that's the next step that he's taking.
Well, it's terrific because, you go to the source, right?
Exactly.
And now that these things are getting translated and being digitized, now we've got to get them in the hands of the educators.
Exactly. And that's an interesting point too, is much of the history that we do have left to be rediscovered is in Hawaiian language. I came across a book titled, and this was maybe published several months after this 1895 rebellion, and it was called the 1895 Civil War, and that's how it was that was the narrative of the time. This was definitely a bigger, skirmish than we think now when we think about a little armed rebellion of a few people trying to get, restore their monarchy. This really was a huge fight that also also included these political prisoners. So
yeah, well, hats off to the folks at the State Archives
yeah.
for sharing that that history, all of our history.
Exactly.
Thanks so much. That was HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi. To learn more about this uncovered history, head to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we head to the movies. If you've been to a movie theater in Hawaii, you've undoubtedly heard the beating of the drums, seen the dancers performing hula kahiko by the light of the fiery torches. The trailer has been playing before movies at Consolidated Theater for decades. The company itself, however, was incorporated in 1917. In the early years, it showed not only movies, but hosted live shows, vaudeville, and concerts featuring artists such as actor Ephraim Zemlist and violinist Baron Menuhin and the Honolulu Symphony. Every Saturday night from 1936 to 1941, Consolidated hosted potluck shows with a 10 p.m. movie plus live entertainment. After the Pearl Harbor bombing, the shows stopped for a few days, but the theater reopened as movies served as a reprieve during martial law. Today, the company is owned by Reading International, a real estate and theater owner with properties in the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand. It has 8 theaters on Oahu and 1 on Maui, and though it no longer runs this particular location, what was the company's first theater? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
How can you use your mind to change your brain? Can that also affect how you feel? Why might inattention help us to focus more? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about the amazing benefits of meditation on the mind. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
As part of Filipino Heritage Month, we decided to take a closer look at a story we ran about a documentary underway. It's about one of the bloodiest labor strikes in Hawaii. The University of Hawaii Oral History Center collected interviews back in the 70s about the strike that left 16 Filipino workers dead. It was the Hanapepe Massacre. Mauro Plateros was a Filipino plantation worker on Kauai when he joined fellow Visayans in the 1924 strike. Some of the strikers weren't happy that Ilocanos weren't participating. The strikers caught 2 Ilocano workers who passed by their strike camp who they believed were insulting them. Plateros witnessed it firsthand and recounts his story.
Where were you now when the Ilocanos first got caught? Were you?
I was down there, and when I was living here, and the Ilocano was about 20 feet from me.
How did they bring him inside?
I think somebody was trying to. I think she had some punching, I think, but it was not so bad, but it was light punching only. Because he had no reason to punch them because he didn't try to fight them.
Had the Ilocanos been bothering the strikers or calling them names, or do you know why brought him inside?
He just passing by every time on the strike camp. This is the yard here. Uh-huh. We are squatting here, and this is the road. They always pass by. Yeah. And they know that kind of way. We don't like them so because they never join us.
Right.
That's why some people think they are insulting us. So that's why the second guider on the strike is called Lorenzo.
Lorenzo.
Yeah, did. I better capture that man.
The night the two were captured, Sheriff William Crowell went to arrest the two men, essentially putting them in protective custody. The strikers refused. The sheriff returned the next day with special police forces and sharpshooters. And according to Plateros, the strikers were only armed with cane knives and a pistol with no bullets. A shot rang out, however, and chaos ensued, leaving 16 dead. Plateros ran and hid. He only returned to the camp because his wife and baby were still there. He was later arrested. We reach out to CLEAR, the Center for Labor Education and Research at West Oahu, to help provide some context for this strike. Director Bill Pewitt credits Kauai student Stu Burley with researching and helping to track down documents that led to a better picture of what really happened that day in 1924. He also talked about the community role that leader Pablo Manglapit played in labor organizing.
Between the two of us, we started putting together materials. I was able to find a 1923 map, geographical survey map, that had a site listed on it that seemed to coincide with all of the stories, but was different from most of the actual narratives that had been written by other people, which thought that they were buried at in Makaveli. There's a Catholic church, and they thought it was going to be over there. Because the Catholic priest officiated. And so just kind of, I think there was a deduction made by a lot of people that it was at the Catholic cemetery at that church. And so, I actually went to that church and talked to the people who were there, and they said they have no record of any burials from that, you know, as a result of that. And they have some burials that go even further back. So anyway, then again, looking at the map that I got, the 1923 survey map, and in the articles, there were several places where they mentioned that the funeral took place right next to the Chinese. One of the officers who was shot was Chinese, and their funerals were like right next to each other, about 100 yards off. And so looking at the survey map, I found by what is today really close to the Oahu Veterans Cemetery, this graveyard that was marked Chinese Filipino. Right, so, and it had a line, the Chinese on one side and the Filipinos on the other. So, and it really corresponded to all the descriptions about where it was and what its relationship was to the, you know, to Hanapepe and the bay and so forth.
So at that point, you knew you
were
onto something.
So I was pretty sure we had that. So that's the material I shared with Stu. And Stu was able to find a caretaker for that cemetery. And the caretaker was a nephew, I guess, of a caretaker who was there at the time period, and had said that they had unearthed some skulls one time when they were digging another grave, and that they realized, oh, you know, this is bad, so they put them all back and reburied them. And so I went over specifically to go with Stu and look at the different sites. And one of our goals was that there was a memorial put in a park in Hanapepe, but that memorial is nowhere near any of the events of the actual story. And the two primary events are where the shooting took place and where they're buried. We really were looking at the possibility of interesting the Filipino community and the state and everybody to establish and verify, confirm that that's where the burials were, because the evidence was pretty overwhelming. And then to try to get a memorial plaque there and also on the road, you know, by across the old Hanapepe Bridge, you know, what was then the Japanese school and is now somebody's home where the shooting actually took place. I thought there should be a roadside
a plaque or memorial or something,
you know, yeah, to indicate this is where that happened. But we're totally unsuccessful at getting that. And I did talk to a bunch of people. One of the HGA business agents was trying to help me get contacts with the State Department of Health and archaeologists, and we basically didn't get very far.
How long ago was that?
And that was in 2006.
Okay.
So then this group, the Congress of Visayan Organizations, they asked me to come over in 2015 to lead a group to look at the sites because they're the Visayan, you know, organizations. And so I went over at that time period and did a little tour. We started at the site of the shooting, and then we went over to the graveyard. And I was disturbed because some of the places that were identified by Stuart looked like they had fresh graves on them. And so, you know, but nothing could be confirmed because there is no excavation. But like I say, all of the documentary evidence was pointing right there.
So when you heard that the team that was working on this documentary did the ground-penetrating radar and found some disturbances, what was your reaction?
Right. Well, a good friend of mine over there who was working with the team, Ray Catania, was asking me about it, and I said, yeah, definitely I think it's a good idea to do the radar. But I said, don't be totally disappointed. In other words, it's not you're not going to be able to prove they weren't buried there, because who knows? Somebody could have, you know, actually in the meantime, with those fresh graves, could have dug them up and reburied them or just disposed of them. So the fact that you don't find anything wouldn't necessarily have disqualified the site.
Right, so you cautioned
them. So I cautioned them about that. So they went anyway, and I'm glad they did, because that's the first real confirmation we have. And it doesn't look like anybody's going to get permission to do any excavation. I fully understand that, you know, disturbing graves. That's something, you know, it's a hard
sensitive.
Step to go for. It's very sensitive, and I understand that. But, you know, at the time period in 2006, that was not an option, the ground-penetrating radar.
But the main thing now is that there be some kind of marker,
yeah,
an acknowledgement.
Right. And so working with some of the Filipino groups over there, Michael Miranda and so forth, and trying to, you know, who I think are great, that they're actually, Michael Miranda, who's another member of the team, was one of the people who was on the tour with the Congress of Visayan organizations back in 2015. So he's very kind and he told me where they're going with it. They have some problems trying to get the plaque on the road because it's property that's currently in the process of being perhaps sold to the county. But certainly the site should be a memorial for
and
that.
And share with our listeners the importance of this particular labor strike.
Sort of the major theme in Hawaii's labor history is that it started off with a lot of, we say racial, but it's more ethnic divides. Okay, some of that was pretty clearly intentional on the part of the employers because, you know, first they were Chinese, and then the Chinese Exclusion Act stopped that, so they couldn't bring Chinese, so they were desperately, you know, flailing around, and they brought Japanese. The Japanese, they brought a lot of Japanese. Conditions were ripe in Japan at that time period after the Meiji Restoration, that there were a lot of displaced farmers, so they were able to bring lots of Japanese over. That had the unexpected consequence that the Japanese were able to organize, and a lot of the early strikes were Japanese strikes, you know, that specifically. And they started sometimes just plantation and then grew to, they were Oahu-wide, you know, strikes and on the neighbor islands as well. And so the planters, and particularly after a 1906 Japanese strike, were looking for another source of labor. So the Philippines, they tried Korea. They tried, you know, it didn't quite work out. The numbers and the motivations weren't there to bring large numbers. But in the Philippines, there were. So we started to see a lot of Filipinos coming in to supplement the Japanese large numbers.
But unlike the Japanese, when we're talking the Philippines, there are all these different dialects.
Yeah, right. That was a huge problem for the Filipinos because the Japanese, on one hand, even though they were from a lot from Okinawa and they were little different places, but they all spoke the same language. There was no communication barriers between them and like that. But the Filipinos, there were, because in the Philippines, there are, I read someplace, 130 actual separate dialect languages, and they're quite different from each other. And although just before that they had adopted Tagalog as the national language, it was still not that common that everybody was going to do this. And particularly when they brought the people in to work in Hawaii, a lot of them were Visayan, and then later they brought in Ilocanos.
And that's what the crux was in this.
And that was
massacre.
The crux of this particular incident. You know, whether massacre is the right term or not, I got criticized. I wrote a book on Hilo, which I still feel justified the term, even though there were no deaths, but because the police were the only ones who had arms, you know, and exercised that kind of
force. They shot a bunch
of workers. They shot 50 people. But in this one, Reinecke calls it the Battle of Hanapepe because they fought back. In 1920, we had what is often called the dual union strike. There were Japanese and Filipinos tried to coordinate a strike. Manlapit, that was his first attempt, and it was kind of a crushing failure on the Filipino side. He wasn't able to get them coordinated, and primarily that was on Oahu, you know, so it was an Oahu strike.
And they were fighting for wages.
They were, yeah, the, each one of the groups had their own, the Japanese call it a higher wage association. The Filipinos at that time in 1920 called it the Filipino Labor Union. All right. But after that strike, which, you know, bottomed out and people, you know, recriminations, there was clearly tactics specifically designed to pit the Filipinos against the Japanese and sow seeds of distrust among the different groups of each other, which were successful. And in this early period, one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, by the 1930s, we start to see later on, that's why it's important, that this kind of ethnic strikes were exclusive to a particular community were doomed. They were never going to be able to have a success in organizing unless they came together.
Ethnic divide in our sugar history and united we stand is what you often hear on the strike lines in current day. That was Bill Pewitt, director of the Center for Labor Education and Research, talking about the significance of the 1924 Hanapepe strike massacre. Efforts are underway to erect a marker at the massacre site and at the gravesite of the 16 Filipino sugar workers.
Coming Saturday, November 9th to HBR's Atherton Studios, the Honolulu Jazz All-Stars brings an evening of jazz standards and swingin' originals fronted by guitarist Doug McDonald, who is known for his beautiful bell-clear tone and a sure-footed sense of swing. This evening is sure to satisfy jazz lovers of all kinds. Get your tickets now at hbrtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's now time for our reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats business reporter Stuart Yurton has been digging around on the wind and solar front. Rough going on the yellow brick road to green energy and the Emerald City. Right, Stuart?
Yeah, it definitely is a rough road, Catherine.
So tell us about what you've been able to uncover on the Kahuku Wind Farm.
So we spoke to a former PUC lawyer, Ryan Hurley. That's the Public Utilities Commission, and they're the ones that approve the deals between the companies that supply the power and the utility, Hawaiian Electric. And it turns out from talking to him, looking back years ago, there were really a lot of people raising serious questions about not just the location of the project, but the process for approving it. And looking at the environmental impact statement and a question of whether that should be approved first before the Public Utilities Commission approves the project.
Right. So that's kind of the concern people have, right? Are we going to see another super ferry or rail?
Well, this is different from that. But the overarching issue is very similar. A lot of people are opposed to it. They've raised this legal question. This legal question isn't the one really at play right now. There's some other things in the works to try to block this. But the overarching problem is this project and others are facing challenges from people in the community.
Well, I wonder if those two other legal challenges will somehow bring this in. I mean, you know, he was the former attorney for the PUC.
That's right. He is a former attorney for the PUC, and he and others, again, including Denise Antolini, who's the assistant or associate dean of the law school years ago. She wasn't in that position then, but she had founded the environmental law program at the University of Hawaii Law School. She made the same point as Ryan Hurley. The consumer advocate also was saying we should do this EIS, which should be completed first. So really the idea was that the PUC, the thought was the consumer advocate said the PUC should really have a full understanding of all the negative consequences of this project, this wind project in Kahuku, before the PUC makes a decision. The idea being that, well, you want to look at everything and be able to really weigh the costs and benefits, really evaluate the trade-offs before approving it.
So
that's what this is all about. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see then if that's something that's going to stand as this gets raised.
That's right. But again, there are other issues that are in play, and those right now are really the focus of some of this litigation. You know, we also saw something else that arose in a different case last week, where opponents of a solar farm on Maui are raising questions about conflicts of interest involving a law firm, so that represented multiple parties in this competitive bidding process. So that too is coming up.
Yeah, that story piqued my interest because one of the names on that law firm, the gentleman was a former PUC member. He was on the commission.
That's right. That's right. But he was not one of the lawyers. But in this case, the law firm is Yamamoto Kalaboso, and it wasn't just that the same firm represented parties. It was actually the same lawyers represented four companies bidding on representing seven different projects that were going through this contract approval process with the PUC. And, you know, the question was, well, should you have the same companies if they're supposedly bidding competitively using the same agent to negotiate with the utility?
Right.
HECO raised a question at the time. The utility raised a question. Again, the consumer advocate raised questions about it. They kind of let it pass, but then this environmental group has stepped up and said, whoa, wait a minute, this is wrong. And even the utility raised it as a question back then.
Yeah, so certainly it's something to look at. If there isn't a conflict there, there certainly is an appearance of conflict. So you'd want to look into that further.
That's exactly right. And that's what the consumer advocate said.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read his stories on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the simply massive universe that surrounds our tiny planet, and also things we can try and look for in the dark skies. We are joined, as usual, by the astronomer Christopher Phillips, who we're so grateful to have on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week's stargazers, the bright planets of Jupiter and Saturn, can be found in the south after sunset. The planet Venus can also be seen low in the west just after the sun sets. The moon is a mere waxing crescent this week. This, of course, means perfect stargazing conditions right through till late next week.
And there's apparently been another one of these very scary near misses that happened. What's the story with this?
Yes. So last Friday, an asteroid twice as wide as the Empire State Building passed by the Earth, missing us by a mere 4 million miles. Now, that may sound like nothing to worry about, but in astronomical terms, it's a bit too close for comfort. And this won't be the last time we hear from this asteroid, as its elliptical orbit will bring it back into our neighborhood in 2140.
Was this something they knew was coming by, or was it a surprise in some way?
So this asteroid was actually discovered back in 1998, so it didn't surprise us. But it's the ones that we don't know about out there that we're really concerned about, and it keeps astronomers up at night.
And so is it really a near miss, though, when they know it's coming? I mean, like, with this particular one that you're talking about, how far out were they thinking, okay, on this day it's going to be closest to Earth?
Well, we can't really tell with these asteroids until they get close to us, because the margin of error is quite large.
Ah.
But in this case, I think we were quite comfortable that it was going to miss us, but we just didn't know by how much.
Okay, I get it. That makes sense. And how do we protect ourselves from one of these things coming a little bit closer than 4 million miles?
Well, right now, finding them is the best defense, and there are multiple asteroid hunting programs in operation across the globe. One of the most important is Pan-STARRS here in Hawaii, and also the LSST telescope, which will come online in Chile, will provide some much-needed coverage in the Southern Hemisphere.
But wouldn't it be much smarter to do like that Bruce Willis movie and just go to an asteroid and try to blow it up or something like that?
Well, first of all, these asteroids are very, very far away, and so sending a manned mission to one of these things is incredibly risky. In fact, we have just enough trouble sending robots there to collect samples, so you can imagine how difficult something like that would be. But I imagine if the case were that dire and it was our last hope, we could probably send something there to blow an asteroid up or deflect it off course. And in fact, people are looking at that right now.
So it's not just a big budget movie idea, huh?
Well, if push comes to shove, definitely not.
That's funny. It is Christopher Phillips and another fascinating Stargazer report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for Kohala High School STEM and Science Facility on Hawaii Island, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking for Consolidated Theater's first movie theater. The company started in 1917, opened its first theater in downtown Honolulu in 1922. Its theaters became hubs of entertainment, showing movies and live performances like vaudeville. In 1992, to commemorate its 75th anniversary, the company commissioned a unique movie trailer featuring dancers performing hula to the beat of drums and by the light of torches. It digitally remastered the trailer for its 100th anniversary in 2017. Many remember the Princess Theater located at Barataria and Fort Street, but Consolidated built its first theater 3 years earlier. It still stands today on the corner of Bethel and Pauahi Streets. The company named it Hawaii Theater. After business slowed, Consolidated closes the Chinatown venue in 1984. The nonprofit Hawaii Theater Center formed to save it from demolition. They raised money, renovated the interior and the marquee, and it is today a venue for bands, comedians, and more. Hawaii Theater is the answer we were looking for, but we had no winners today. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Many Hands Make Light Work is the title of a film that Uluulu, the Digital Moving Pictures Archives, is showcasing at the upcoming Hawaii International Film Festival. The screening will include a forum with two of the surviving weavers. A third weaver, Frances Williamson, is in her 80s, and she couldn't make the trip, or she can't make the trip, next month, but she spoke with us by phone. She's one of a cadre of weavers hired by artist Ruth Adele Anderson, who the state awarded the contract to create two 40-foot tapestries to hang in the chambers of the House and Senate. It would take a couple of years to complete and stands as an outstanding art piece as part of the state's Art in Public Places program.
And so I took my one piece of weaving and I went to Ruth Adele and said, "What do you think?" And she said, "You're on." And I went to work for 50 cents an hour.
So how many people were involved in creating this?
Well, five weavers mostly did the weaving. There are inconsistencies from one weaver to another. The fewer you have working on a project, the better. And we did nothing but commissions for public buildings, so that there were other jobs that needed doing at the same time. And there were about, I think we had 16 or so people in the studio altogether, because as you know, the walls on both of those chambers curve, and you probably, if you think, stop and think about it, weaving or woven things or fabric things don't come curved. They come flat. And so you have to make allowances on how you're going to deal with that curvature. And so we had a fellow who did metal work, and he made extruded aluminum mesh pieces that were exactly the same piece as the weaving, and the pieces were, the shape of the pieces was arrived at by having the wall surveyed so that you could have two parallel lines, and before the round the room curvature took over, you could stop it, and then you could just alter the fact, make the top and the bottom not parallel. You can't, you know, looms are set up to do two even sides that are straight. That's the way fabric comes off of almost every loom there is. And so we had to work with, you know, we had to work our way around the room, literally, accounting for that curve. Now, there are 44 pieces, separate pieces, in each of the murals that are not attached at all to each other anywhere. They're attached, what fellows put up the scaffolding and Mark measured out the wall, and they put furring strips on the wall, and the pieces are attached to those.
Interesting.
But they butt up against each other, and all of it is pretty much, most of it is knotted. It's the same knot that you use to make rugs with. And when you butt two pieces up together, because it's knotted, it can fall over. So we had to go up and go run a finger or some sort of most of us, we just used our finger to run up and down where the pieces are butt against each other so that nothing got squinched up down in the seam, you know, because they weren't attached. They were being just put up there together so that they touched, but they weren't attached to each other.
So was it particularly tricky? Was one, you know, more difficult than the other?
No. The designs that I made, that was my first job, was to take my slide rule and the figures that the surveyors had and got the angles that would be inside the weaving so that we had parallel sides and non-parallel tops and bottoms. And you just figure out the sine of the angle of the opposite over the adjacent and all that. And you use your geometry and create these pieces so that you can weave them off. Only the outer side of each mural has a shaped edge because it is smaller at the top than it is at the bottom. It has a slight shape to it. And so those outer pieces are not exactly, they don't have parallel sides on up and down, but all the other pieces do. And I made a scale model, a foot to an inch, or an inch to a foot, and Ruth Adele, I made paper model for her, and she was doing the final color combinations, because each of the they called butterflies, which is it's a hand bobbin is what it is. You make a hand bobbin with your yarn and pull so that you pull on it and it comes apart. And she had three different colors in each butterfly. And so they had all this yarn, 700 pounds of yarn that was hand-dyed for each or specifically dyed for each piece. And she hadn't decided on, what if you use a lighter blue here instead of a darker blue, and that, you know, how, what the nuances were. And that's what she used the scale models for, to select exactly which one of the yarns she would put together with the others.
What was maybe one of your favorite memories during that whole process? I mean, how long did it take? And
it took a year to do each one. There's a lot of work. We worked 6 days a week. We did have other commissions, but nothing anywhere near the size of that. The next large thing that we did were the pieces that are in the Prince Cohio Federal Building.
And this particular artwork, or these two pieces of artwork, gosh, I mean, I don't know the story behind them. Did they have names or themes or?
No, Ruth Adele, people kept asking her that. And what happened was the colors were predetermined because the carpeting was already on the floor. And they had selected earth colors for the House and water colors for the Senate. So she knew that it would have to go with the carpeting wasn't going to be changed. She had to accommodate what those colors were and work with that as the starting point for her design. And people would say, well, doesn't that look like a Hawaiian cape? And she would say, well, not exactly. You don't want to say, not to me. So she really didn't have anything but creating an abstract design that was pleasant to look at and pleasing to the eye and blended well with the carpeting and fit into the room. And then the one with the ocean colors, well, it was the same thing. She didn't want to have the design be the same with just different colors either. I mean, she wanted each one to be individual.
And what was your, I guess, fondest memory?
Ruth Adell was a very good cook, an excellent cook. We always had a birthday celebration for each person as the birthdays came along throughout the year. We would have things like marinated mushrooms. And Ruth Adell must have gone home for a week and every night and just cooked until it was time to go to bed. And Webb would come up here at noontime with everything in the car. And Eve Marie Judd would make her chocolate birthday cake, which is chocolate, a real yummy chocolate cake with yummy chocolate frosting. We worked very hard, actually. It was hard work, physical work, but it was such a pleasure to know that we were doing something that would become part of Hawaii forever, or as long as it would last. And every Saturday, Ruth Adell loved opera. Every Saturday, we listened to the Texaco opera. And a lot of us were not... I'd been to operas, but I'd never really fallen in love with the art form. And we listened to opera every Saturday, so we got our education right along with it. Our music appreciation time came no matter what.
Do you have a favorite opera tune or one that sticks in your mind?
No, I don't. No, but you'd think that we might have had, after two whole years of listening to what Texaco was putting on, we all went to our task trying not to talk too much, so we didn't want to disturb the opera.
Okay. So. That sounds like a wonderful memory, though.
It is, yeah. It was... We all got along very well together, and it was fun to work with people who were having fun doing what they were doing.
And I understand that mainly it was women, but there was one man?
Yes, Charlie. One of the other people that worked for us was Margaret Donnell, and her dad was in city planning at the university. And Kyrie Tata Ishii, her husband was one of the first entrepreneurs from Japan when they began being very interested in Hawaii property.
Gosh, anything else you want to share? I'm sure you must have been so proud once this finished.
Oh, my. It was quite something. And as I say, I just hope that more people will realize that these things are there, and the pieces that we did for the federal building are in the judicial section. The pieces are great. They hang in a mezzanine, and some of them are two stories tall. It was in 1995, I think, that they just about took the Capitol down to the rock bottom because they discovered asbestos, and of course it all had to be removed. So those pieces came down lock, stock, and barrel. The whole show, House and Senate, and they hired Ruth Adell. She had them build a kind of a rack that would hold the pieces. She vacuumed them. That's all it takes. You know, they wanted to know, how do we clean these? And she said, you get a vacuum cleaner. You know, it's the real secret. So she cleaned them up and checked the back to make sure everything was staying in position where it had been sewn. Also, the pieces that go over the loudspeakers, which are in the middle of each piece, that have to be removable for maintenance and or repair, they have approved acoustical material behind the wire, the mesh, that actually covers the speakers.
What is it about weaving that you love?
I guess you start with so little and you end up with something so exciting quite often. You know, you start out with just thread, and you put it on the loom, and it's just threads going up and down. And then you start with the threads that go across, and you add color and shape and design, and then all of a sudden it's not, they aren't just threads.
Yeah, well, you have two wonderful woven pieces that are pieces of art.
Well, it was great fun to do.
You've been listening to Weaver Frances Williamson, the documentary about the Capitol Weavers presented by Ulu Ulu. The West Oahu Digital Archives is set to be screened November 10th at 4 p.m. at Regal Dole Cannery Theaters at the Hawaii International Film Festival. So mark your calendars.
Hi, I'm Leanne Pedro, General Manager of Hawaiian Cool Water, proud sponsor and supporter of HPR. Our relationship, like all relationships, especially here in an island community, is very important. And so we underwrite and support because of our like values. So we want to be community contributors because we live here, we give here.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, all things solar. It's a call-in show. Next week, the solar industry kicks off its expo. What's the snapshot of the solar landscape? We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back. Leave your comments. If you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on the conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for the conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation. Thank you.